The Tom Woods Show, episode 1037.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, now you can look like $1 million without having to earn $1 million. Tom Woods listeners can now get Indochino's best deal ever. $359 for any premium suit when you enter the code WOODS during checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit with free shipping. Check it out at Indochino.com and use promo code WOODS. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined once again by our friend Scott Horton, who is the libertarian foreign policy expert. And we thought we'd do a little scorecard today of the war on terror and go through, let's see, how many places do I have here? 7 different places, and see what the current situation is and what the outcome has been of U.S. intervention. Scott, as you may know, is the host of Anti-War Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles. He's also the host of The Scott Horton Show, which you can find out about at scotthorton.org, because there you can find he's done 4,500 interviews, more than 4,500 interviews, which makes my 1,000 episodes look like a piece of nothingness. It's unbelievable what Scott has accomplished. He's also the managing director of the Libertarian Institute, which you should check out at libertarianinstitute.org, and the author of the new book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Scott, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be here.
I'm telling you, Scott, you were a major ingredient in why the Contra Cruise was so successful. I mean, it was a lot of fun for a lot of reasons, but having you with us and your generosity with your time and your brain power with everybody and staying up late and teaching people things all day long was just an indispensable part of that event. And it's just it was an unforgettable time, and I think you were a major, major part of that.
Well, listen, I mean, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you inviting me along and having me there. I mean, really, if I sat and wrote about it, I don't think I could tell you how much I really appreciate it, Tom. It's really something else, you and Bob too. And for all the people, I mean, I can't go down all the names and whatever, but I met a lot of great people. And there's a, boy, you turn out, and you told me before, you're like, this is going to be a great crowd. You just watch. And man, it was a lot of fun.
And man, are they Scott Horton fans or what?
Yeah, well, they are now.
Some of them were converted on the cruise, but others, I mean, I don't think they would mind my mentioning their names. The Haymans are just such heroic people.
Yeah, we're good friends from now on, too.
Yeah, exactly. Lifelong friends. They would crawl over broken glass if it would help Scott Horton.
Well, I'll tell you what, too, man. I dream about being on that boat all the time.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I dream about looking out at the waves with Dave and Michael and hanging out and all that. But also, I think I keep having this recurring dream where I'm like walking around the dining room and I'm trying to explain to people, like, here's this one little thing that you can do to help end the war. I don't know what the hell it is, right? But it's like, oh, it's really fun and easy and you can all participate. So yeah, I have no idea. And also I feel like I'm rocking still like that George Carlin bit. You ever feel like you go out, spend a day on the high seas and then you still, there's party inside that's still out there rocking.
You know, I know we got to talk about the war on terror, but honestly, that was such a fake world we lived in for that week where your every desire is provided for, like, and you're with great people. You don't want any of the days to end. And then to watch Dave did stand up for us that was tailored specifically to our group. It was just absolutely unforgettable. So if we ever do another one, people, I'm telling you, when we tell you it's a great event, we're not just blowing smoke. This is real, absolute truth. It was a fantastic event.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And Michael Bolden was, you know, he was really the life of the party the whole time. Even more than our professional comedian. No offense to Dave.
You know, and by the way, the reason
nobody's got energy like Michael Bolden, man.
Invited Michael, even though he's not as well known, let's say, as Dave might be, but I invited him not so much for the 10th Amendment stuff, although that was a bonus, but simply because he's such a fun guy to hang around with. And I thought people need to see this for themselves. And they all walked away saying, yes, Michael Bolden has to be part of my life forever now. So anyway, the chemistry between everybody was just great. It was just amazing. All right, let's talk. We have to get depressed again now. So you and I are going to do a little different episode today. Normally we pick some topic, we go super, super deep into it to the point where people have to listen to the episode 17 times. This time, we're going to try to spend just a little time in seven different places. And I'm going to go in the order in which you provided the places to me, because we're basically doing a scoreboard for the war on terror and how it's going. So let's start with the topic of your latest book, your book, Fool's Errand.
Tell them how much you like the book, Tom.
Okay. First of all, I love this book, but it's not just because, well, it's Tom Woods and he likes Scott Horton, so of course he's going to like it. The people on the cruise were raving about the book like it was the greatest book that had ever been written. I'm not kidding you. And, I mean, okay, it's got great endorsements and everything else, but it's so crushing and devastating that after you read it, you feel like your mission in life is to get other people to read it. And that's the kind of book it is. So when Scott gave his talk on the cruise, he brought a bunch of books to sell. The books were gone in like a 50th of a second as soon as they heard him talk. So give us the update. What's going on in Afghanistan? Why do you say we're losing?
Well, yeah, we are. So like I say in the book, we never had to have that war at all. We could have negotiated for bin Laden. But even if you think we had to attack to get Al-Qaeda, we still didn't have to attack the Taliban. But even if you think, yeah, no, we had to attack the Taliban because that's what they get for harboring Al-Qaeda, then we still didn't have to stay and install a government there. But then even if you say, yeah, no, we for whatever reason, we had to try to create a government there, we still didn't have to pick a fight with this Pashtun insurgency. And then we did, we being the U.S. military and spies and Bush government, picked a fight with the plurality Pashtun population of the country, and now they can't defeat it. And so what they're on, basically, they're in a situation where as long as they stay, they never quite lose. And so that's what Donald Trump did at the end of August, was announced that, well, we're going to stay and keep losing slowly, but without ever being forced all the way out of the country. That loss, in the words of President Bush, will be up to other presidents to decide some other time in the future. And so, you know, here we are with at least, 100,000 dead. Nobody really knows how many Afghan civilians have been killed in this thing. The longest foreign war in American history, 16 years on. And all they can do with their brilliant new strategy is say, well, we're going to bring the Indians in to back the government in Kabul even more than before, when we've been asking for their help all along and getting them to buy Russian helicopters for us to get around our own sanctions and all this stuff. But all that's going to do, Tom, of course, is provoke the Pakistanis into the same reaction. They're just going to increase their same reaction, which is to keep backing this Taliban insurgency resistance against us in order to prevent India and their friends from consolidating power over the country. So the whole thing is just a perpetual motion machine. We could have this exact same conversation in 15 years, in another 16 years, and it'll be the same thing again.
What do you say to people who argue that failed states become hotbeds for terrorist training and activity, and therefore
quit making them? Yeah, quit overthrowing secular dictatorships. Well, or even, why overthrow the Taliban in the first place again? But then look at the terror war. Al-Qaeda attacked us. So what do? We attack, we're going to go down the list here. We attack Iraq, overthrow the government in the secular government in Iraq, in Yemen, in Libya, and then half a regime change in Syria. None of these governments were tied to Al-Qaeda at all. They were all governments that kept Al-Qaeda down. And we overthrow them and create all this space. So I'm getting ahead of the game, but that's the terror war. We had 400 terrorists to kill, and instead we killed everybody else and turned 400 into 40,000.
You know, I know this has nothing to do directly with that, but the news is coming in that Mitt Romney is edging closer to a Senate run in 2018 to replace Orrin Hatch, whom we presume to be retiring. And, Trump's a big disaster in terms of expectations and not living up to them and being all over the map and whatever. And yet the never Trump side on foreign policy is at least as bad. So in other words, here's your choice. You can have Trump or Romney. What the heck? Isn't that, this is terrible. Just terrible. Unspeakable.
Yeah, Trump is unpredictably, but predictably bad on everything, but in sort of a seemingly unpredictable way. But Romney is just a walking prediction of everything wrong that he could possibly do. I mean, that's it. Yeah. He's bad on every single thing. And he even has read about it and knows a little bit about it. And that's why he's so bad on every single thing. So no improvement there. I'll tell you.
I know. If there were a President Romney, you and I could do an episode on exactly what he would do, all the things that he would wind up doing that are wrong. All right. Well, what's going on in Pakistan then? Let's go to the next one.
Well, so the drone war against al-Qaeda fighters in Pakistan really, you know, wound down years ago because they'd already won. I mean, they really did. I don't want to give them too much credit because there was a lot of consequences and a lot of innocent people killed. But the CIA really did hunt down and kill almost all of the real al-Qaeda guys hiding in Pakistan in, you know, say the first 4 or 6 years of Obama times. But Trump has started bombing them again. And I don't know exactly who he's bombing there, but there are plenty of fighters in the Afghan theater who have safe haven hiding across the border in Pakistan and supported by the Pakistani state. And as I was saying, American help for the Indians or requests for help from the Indians for America's mission in Afghanistan only agitates our Pakistani allies and puts them in the position of increasing their support for our enemies in Afghanistan, in the Taliban and the Haqqani network. And so, I'm not sure exactly who they've been attacking there, if it's the Haqqanis or who it is. But I recommend to people because, you know, honestly, the worst blowback we suffered here from the war in Pakistan so far was the failed attempt to blow up Times Square in 2010, which actually could have been really bad. But the guy was unable to pull it off with his truck bomb there. So this seems pretty far away to most Americans, maybe. But I would encourage people to read Living Under Drones, about what it's like to be a little girl growing up with just the buzz of Predator and Reaper drones in the sky for your entire childhood, and then occasionally vaporizing people that you know and love, and just the absolute, well, you know, the crack up, the total shell shock that these people, you know, grow up with. It's the same in the Gaza Strip and wherever America and its allies have these kind of air wars against helpless peasants on the ground who can't even shoot back, and, you know, drives them absolutely out of their minds. So next time we do have bad blowback from Pakistan, don't be surprised.
But if you're willing to concede that the CIA did get some actual bad guys, then how would you answer the neocon argument that, look, it's regrettable, but how else do you expect us to get the bad guys? There are going to be some innocents who die.
Well, the thing is, they could have had the Taliban arrest them and hand them over back in 2001. And then when they refused to negotiate with the Taliban, they invaded. But then they focused all their efforts on the Taliban and not al-Qaeda. And they let al-Qaeda escape at Tora Bora. They killed about 300 or 400 of them. And then they let another couple hundred of them go. And these are the guys that they ended up having to mop up later. And then now you hear them talk about, and I know you read this in the book, they talk about, oh, no, ISIS is in Afghanistan. ISIS, ISIS. Well, who's ISIS in Afghanistan? Well, they're Pakistani Taliban refugees from Obama's drone war in Pakistan that he waged in 2010. So when Obama escalated on the Pakistani side of the border, Pakistani Taliban, which is a totally separate group from the Afghan Taliban, came across the border, settled in Nangarhar province in eastern Afghanistan, and then after a little while declared themselves loyal to the Islamic State. So they're actually still just local Pashtun fighters, but now they have the same brand name as international Arab terrorists. So we have to stay to fight them forever. But all they are is the consequences of the crackdown against the al-Qaeda guys in Afghanistan. You know, General McChrystal himself said, he called insurgent math. He said 10 minus 2 equals 20. You kill two people, you create 20 new enemies. This is what happens. And this is, of course, what has been the case this whole time, is all of this is blowback from America picking these fights.
I want to skip Yemen and come back to that later. Let's talk about Syria. Now, wouldn't it be plausible for somebody to say that the news headlines are all saying that ISIS is really shrinking and on the run, and so this is something that somebody can claim victory for, certainly. So why would you say we're losing?
Yeah, well, of course, the only reason ISIS came into existence was because America, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel supported the al-Qaeda jihadists and their friends Jabhat al-Nusra, that is, and Arar al-Sham and the Nur al-Zinki, the Farouk Brigade and the Northern Storm and all these so-called FSA groups, who are basically all just a bunch of bin Ladenite terrorists led by Jabhat al-Nusra. ISIS is just a breakoff group from al-Qaeda. They're not the opposite. They're blood brothers. They're the Iraqi-dominated faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II that, when Obama helped start the war in Syria in 2011, they came across from Iraq and started setting up their part of the war there. And then these guys basically stopped obeying Zawahiri and created their own little caliphate there, which lasted for 3 years. And which, as soon as once the Islamic State spread from eastern Syria all the way into conquering western Iraq, oh, now they're a problem in 2014. So then Obama had to start Iraq War III in order to smash them, to drive them out of Crete, Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul, and Tal Afar, and basically all of Anbar province and Nineveh province in Iraq. And this was all direct consequences of American intervention in support of the jihad in the first place. If America had not intervened, and if Obama had told the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris, oh, no, you don't, we may all hate Assad, but America, we hate al-Qaeda more and we mean it, then Assad would have won, would have crushed whatever uprising in 2011. There never would have been an Islamic State at all. And then you're right that, yes, now that Iraq War III has been successful and America has helped the Shiite forces in Iraq again to defeat the Sunni-based insurgency there, now we set up for a brand new conflict between the Kurds and the Shia in Iraq over who's going to control Kirkuk. Whereas before, that had basically been settled with facts on the ground and sharing agreements. So now we're setting up for Iraq War IV to take place with America backing both sides of that one. And we still have al-Qaeda in western Syria, in the Idlib province. And we have the Saudis are trying to use them to pick a fight with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So, you know, this is far from over. And of course, America has used in Iraq and in Syria as well, has used the Kurds as our local militia backed by special operations forces on the ground. Well, guess what? They want autonomy. They want maybe independence. But that's only going to pick a fight with our NATO ally, the Turks, who want to crush them because the YPG, our friends, the Kurds in Syria, are the enemies of the Turkish government. They're the friends of the PKK in Turkey that the Turks consider a terrorist group. So any, you know, short-term success anyone can point at in any of these missions, particularly in the Levant and Mesopotamia, I mean, they're just blowing smoke and ignoring the context outside of their immediate field of vision. You know, look, we smashed IS in Raqqa. Yeah, but look at al-Nusra in the Idlib province. They're still there. And really, it was the Russians and the Syrian government and Hezbollah and Iranian Quds Force guys who ended up winning the war on terrorism there when Donald Trump finally stopped the CIA support for al-Qaeda in the last, you know, 6 months.
All right, more spectacular failures to get to in just a minute after we thank our sponsor. Folks, I saw a funny image on Facebook the other day. On one side was a man in a suit who was professional and had a job. And on the other side was a guy in a baggy suit that didn't even come close to fitting him, who had gotten the suit because he had a court date. And let me tell you something. When people look at you, they know the difference. And even though in this day and age it's fashionable to be casual and look like a slob, if you want to be taken seriously, you want to look your best. And there's no better way to do that than with a made-to-measure suit. And with Indochino, you won't break the bank. I've had a great experience with them. The process of ordering and figuring out my size couldn't have been easier. And then before you know it, you have a perfectly tailored suit at an incredible price. You can choose from hundreds of top quality fabrics, personalize your suit just the way you want it. You can head into a showroom or shop online at Indochino.com. And get this, now Tom Woods listeners can get Indochino's best deal ever. $359 for any premium suit when you enter the code WOODS during checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit with free shipping. Indochino.com, promo code WOODS for any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. That's an incredible deal for a suit that'll fit you better than anything off the rack ever could. All right, let's talk about Somalia. I mean, what libertarian discussion would be complete without a discussion of Somalia? What's going on in Somalia that has anything to do with the war on terror?
Yeah, great question. Listen, if people want to really know about this, I wrote a thing. Just type in FFF for Future Freedom Foundation, FFF Somalia, and you can read my article that I wrote, U.S. Government Responsible for Somalia's Misery, where I try to sum all this up for you. But basically, after the advent of the war on terrorism in 2001, the CIA started backing the warlords there, the bad guys from Black Hawk Down, Adid and his son, basically, and his friends hunt down Islamists and kill them for us. Now, it's the time immediately before this is when libertarians correctly say, and I mean real economists at universities and stuff have written studies and said when Somalia was anarchy land and no one ruled the place, that was when they were best off. And this is somehow a caricature that somehow we're supposed to ignore the fact that the USA has been turning that country upside down for 16 years straight now. The whole terror war long, and we're supposed to say freedom is to blame for whatever's wrong in Somalia. That's the liberal cliche. Oh, yeah, oh, you want a free society, huh? Why don't you move to Somalia where everything is horrible? Yeah, but the USA, the most powerful government in world history, has been butchering people in there this whole time, so that doesn't count. It's the period before that is when there was no one collecting taxes at the port. There was no one regulating the creation of these new companies, and they had the greatest growth rate in technology and cell phone service and so forth at the time, at the turn of the last century. It was the best time for a country coming out of communism like the Chinese, coming from basically nothing, from they'd been reduced to nothing, and they were doing great until America came and turned their country upside down. So we started backing the warlords, which provoked a response. So we backed the warlords more, which provoked more of a response. And finally, what had been an anarchy formed in a crisis into a new state, the Islamic Courts Union, and they kicked the warlords out of the country and into Ethiopia in 2005. So Islamic Courts Union, oh no, it has the name Islam in it. And yeah, they shut down a movie theater or two or whatever. They didn't have the power to be anything like an authoritarian dictatorship, and they were not Al-Qaeda guys. And the Somali tradition is far from, you know, hardcore bin Ladenite Wahhabism and all of this stuff. America could have dealt with them, but instead America hired the Ethiopian government next door, their historic rivals, a Christian army, to come in, and they committed scarlet war crimes, rape and torture and murder, and turned the country completely upside down. And you can go back and read about it at the time, Christmas 2006. It was CIA and Special Operations Forces supported the entire thing, and rendition and torture and all the rest of it involved. And then we've been supporting regional governments there, the Ethiopians, the Kenyans, the Burundis, and whoever in the African Union forces attempting to prop up a government and wage a war against the insurgency there. And at the time that the war started, Al-Shabaab, the Islamic Courts Union, was 13 groups. Al-Shabaab, that's the youth. They were the smallest, least influential group. But then the war started, and of course, who does the fighting? The youth. So they're the ones with the AKs, and now they've inherited the power, and it's been back and forth and up and down. But the chaos of the war has, during a time of periodic severe droughts, has led to the deaths of probably certainly better than a million people who otherwise could have lived. But, you know, the markets are completely broken. The farmers can't sow their crops. They can't harvest them. They can't take them to market. There is no market. There is no money. And so at the time that I wrote that article was back in 2000, I think 13. And yeah, it was. And that was when, you know, 500,000 people had starved to death there. And it's true that there was a terrible drought, but the terrible drought in the Horn of Africa, it hit Somalia the hardest because of the state of war and chaos that America had sowed there. So, I mean, it really is among the worst of the crimes of the history of the U.S. government. I mean, up there with exterminating the Lakota.
Well, of course, I'm going to make it easier on people to find your article. I'll just link to it on the show notes page. That's tomwoods.com/1037. What about Libya? Aren't conditions at least improving since the depths of the chaos after getting rid of Gaddafi? Haven't things improved somewhat?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so, but I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of violence, and, you know, far be it from me to complain they don't have a single central government, but the problem is there are two or three competing governments, and they all want to be the central government. So there's a lot of fighting, and there's a lot of foreign intervention, and I admit to you, I plead guilty that Libya is the one that I'm least good on. The best interview I ever did is a lady named Belle, with one L, Belle True, T-R-E-W, And she had written this thing for Foreign Policy where she broke down all the foreign powers in the region and which sides they were on, the Egyptians and the Saudis and the Turks and everybody else. And as best I can tell, Tom, the Americans are behind the government in Tripoli, while their sock puppet, Haftar, who had been living outside, right outside of CIA headquarters for 30 years or something before they parachuted him in there in 2011, he has control of Benghazi. And, you know, there's been skirmishes and threats and all that. I guess nobody's really strong enough to go to total war against the other, but it's far from settled there. I don't know exactly, you know, the level of humanitarian crisis. But also, I did read a thing a couple of months ago about, you know, everybody focuses on the East and the West. Well, there's a whole South of Libya too. And this thing was about all the jihadists and all the arms smugglers and all the lawlessness going on down there since the central government was destroyed and nobody's in charge. And what's really at least as bad as what's happened in Libya. And by the way, there are huge anti-black pogroms. The entire city of Tawerga was, you know, basically liquidated of its civilian population because all blacks were accused of being in on it with Gaddafi. And it's in Hillary's emails, not the WikiLeaks ones, but the State Department ones, where Sidney Blumenthal warned her, hey, the jihadist guys that we're backing here are rounding up and executing blacks, just so you know. And yeah, well, they did. And then anyway, the war spread to Mali. You're hearing about this story about two Navy SEALs murdered a Green Beret Special Forces soldier, Army soldier in Mali. Well, what are they doing in Mali? They're chasing the consequences of Libya, of Hillary and Obama's war in Libya, where the Tuareg fighters went to northern Mali to declare independence from the south, and then the jihadists co-opted their revolution back in 2012 and 13. So we're fighting there, and then as you also heard about our Special Forces guys getting shot and killed in Niger, where they're on missions hunting down wherever a guy claims to be a Muslim and has a rifle. Well, that counts as Al-Qaeda and part of the war on terrorism. So we can spread our special operations forces all through Africa. And the terror war is already spreading. We've got drone bases in Chad and in Niger. There's already been blowback terrorist attacks in Burkina Faso and I believe also in Sierra Leone. So this can just go on forever. I mean, if you've seen pictures of Africa from space, that's a lot of war on terror you can wage forever if you want to. If you'll let them.
All right. Well, now let's talk about one of the crown jewels of the war on terror, which is the war in Iraq. How is that shaping up these days? I mean, I hate that word.
I know, me too. I know I've been talking like that this whole interview and everybody's getting annoyed, but it's English language and I'm stuck with it too.
Yeah, no, I know exactly. I know it. There's nothing we can do. Nothing we can do.
Yeah.
So 2017 now, so 14 years later, what do we have to show for that? Saddam's not in power anymore. That's what Jonah Goldberg will tell you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got to say, this is just the original sin of all of this. I mean, of all of the horrible things, never even mind Iraq War One and Iraq War One and a Half under Bill Clinton and all of that. But just of all of the worst things that you did not have to do was invade and overthrow the government of Iraq. And the bottom line is America still this whole time, we're fighting for Iran's friends, the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council. Those are the guys who are the political leaders of the Shiite supermajority in Iraq. And we've been fighting a civil war for them this entire time. We'd finished kicking the Sunnis out of Baghdad. They had finished kicking the Sunnis out of Baghdad by the end of 2007. And they had, you know, really, yeah, 2008. And with the surge, it wasn't just the war, but especially the surge, the completion of that sectarian cleansing meant that the Shia powers were then permanently deprived of any last incentive to compromise with the Sunnis. They can all just bake out there in the sun. Screw them. They're the 20% minority. They don't have the oil. The oil is all the way down in the south and up in the north under the control of the Shia and under the control of the Kurds. And so what are they going to do about it, basically? And they just absolutely revolted. You know, David Petraeus's promise that the surge worked was that the benchmarks would be accomplished. And those benchmarks were that they would be cut in on the patronage, and they just weren't at all. And so therefore, when in 2013, a year before the creation of the Islamic State, Patrick Coburn was on my show saying, hey, the Shiite Iraqi army basically has no control over Mosul. The guys are AWOL. They're basically like on Fort Apache in a foreign country, way out far away on foreign territory. And they're AWOL. They're retreating back behind safe Shiite lines. There's no one in control. Meanwhile, America was supporting the terrorist war and the rise of the Islamic State in Syria next door. And so that was why listeners to my show knew that they were going to create the Islamic State was going to change from the name of a group to the name of a place, that it was in the process of doing it. I spent a year, and especially the last 6 months, the first 6 months of 2014, saying, oh, man, the other shoe's going to drop. Right when Obama was saying, oh, ISIS, they're the junior varsity. I was going, he is not taking into account that Western Iraq is wide open. And then so that was the start of Iraq War III then. And then America fought another war on behalf of the Shia to help their forces kick the Islamic State out of all the cities of the Iraqi West. And so now, of course, if you listen to Jonah Goldberg and everybody writes for him at the National Review and the rest of their neocon ilk, they go, oh, my God, look, Tom, it's the rise of Iranian Shiite power in the region. How did that happen? Who's going to stop them? This is Jonah Goldberg, who wrote Baghdad Delenda Est in two parts. He said every 10 years or so, America has to take some weak, crappy little country and throw it up against the wall just to prove we mean business. Paraphrasing Michael Ledeen. And that was why we had to destroy the entire civilization of Iraq, never mind just overthrow the country there. That's why we had to raise their entire culture to the ground and kill a million people and create all this chaos. And now they go, oh my God, the Shia now have a real crescent on the ground of power that connects all the way through from Tehran through Baghdad to Damascus and to Beirut. And so now it's a whole new emergency because history began yesterday. And now who's going to confront the problem of Iranian power in the region, which America has aided and abetted this entire time? And one more thing, and I told you this before. Why did America support the Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria? Well, Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic in 2012, in the article is about Iran's nuclear program, as president, I don't bluff. And he tells Jeffrey Goldberg, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg, if we get rid of Assad, that would help bring Iran down a peg. Because Assad is the only Arab state allied, you know, Assad's government in Damascus is the only government in the region, the Arab state allied with Iran. And so, yes, we're doing this nuclear deal with them, but sort of in order to prove to you that we're not tilting toward them now, just like they said in their own plain language about the war in Yemen, we have to placate the Saudis. So at the same time, we're literally securing their interests by scaling back the Iranian nuclear program, which was already a civilian program anyway. We have to placate their upset by waging these wars. And of course, Israel's a big part of that too, because they're obsessed with Hezbollah. And of course, what's all occurred as a result of this? Hezbollah is more powerful than ever before, just like Iran is now more powerful than ever before.
Now, I know Trump was pretty clear about his views on Iran during the campaign, so it's not a surprise that he's continuing with that. It goes to show the Horton's Law, right? That the worst things they promise, they will keep those promises. The good things, forget about it. And that really has, I think, in large part come true under Trump. But with Iran, it seems like given that the bipartisan hostility toward Iran, it seems like the only possibility you'd have for some kind of work toward a true rapprochement with Iran would have to come from some kind of radical outsider with no connections to the regime. And yet Trump, being that person, nevertheless has zero interest in doing that. So that's maybe what's most discouraging about it.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think the image of Donald Trump is perfect for this, and all the complaining about Russia, Russia, Russia notwithstanding. He's tall enough. He's Republican enough. He's a capitalist from Manhattan enough that if he took General Mattis with him, and for that matter, Rex Tillerson, and they went to Tehran and met with the Ayatollah and worked out a deal, Nixon goes and shakes hands with Mao Zedong style, it would be fine. It would be perfect. They could do the same thing in Pyongyang. Hey, guess what, Kim? We're on our way. Clear space on your runway because Air Force One is landing. We're coming to make friends. We're dropping sanctions. We're opening up relations. We're bringing our basketball teams with us. We insist on getting along now. Ceasefire's not good enough. Let's sign a peace treaty, friend. And then what are you going to do? Attack him as being a weak, soft, hippie, liberal Jane Fonda traitor? No, of course not. He's doing this because he's smart. He's doing this because he's brave and right-wing enough and nationalist and America first enough to do the right thing and make peace and end the threat of conflict with either of these countries. But he won't do it because he just doesn't have the depth. He probably couldn't even, you know, really see what I just said. I mean, he did tweet the other day. He said, when are the fools and haters going to realize that it's a good thing to get along with Russia? We need their help to solve problems in Syria, Ukraine, and North Korea. Like, hey, other than crushing Jeb and Hillary, that one tweet was the best thing about this guy in his entire life. Like, that is just absolutely true. Assuming that what you want in Syria, Ukraine, and Korea is peace, then how could you possibly argue with that? Now, at the same time, he's escalating American force deployments in Eastern Europe and this kind of thing. So it's not like he's Ron Paul up there really practicing what he's preaching 100%, but at least he's got basically the mindset that who wants a fight with Russia? The Soviet Union is gone, 25 years gone. And whatever problem you have with Putin, we can deal. And as we've talked about before on the show, Tom, every major move Putin has made over the last in this century has been in reaction to what America has been doing to pick a fight with them. And that's true in Georgia, in Ukraine, in Syria, and everywhere else.
All right. Well, finally, let's turn to Yemen, where you hear mainstream sources saying that these people are on the verge, potentially, of a humanitarian catastrophe we can hardly begin to fathom. How did it get to that point?
Yeah, well, so it's almost like a Somalia type story. The entire war on terrorism writ small. So first Bush, but then especially Obama, we can fast forward to Obama years, backed the dictator Saleh in order to basically bribe him to allow the CIA to target Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula there, the guys that sent the underpants bomber. All right, well, all that ever did was grow Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, not shrink it, again with the insurgent math, as you know. But at the same time, Saleh, the dictator that Obama was bribing, he was taking all his new guns and money, and he kept attacking this group of Shiites in the north, the Zaydi Shiites, and this political group is called the Houthis. And he kept attacking them over and over again, which of course only made them stronger. They kept defeating him 4 or 5 times. They drove his forces back and got stronger and stronger in the process. Then 2011 comes and virtually all factions in the country are sick of Saleh. He's been our dictator, sock puppet over there for 30 something years by then, 25 years or something. So Hillary intervenes and instead of just letting the process work itself out in Yemen how it will, she intervenes, forces him out, but keeps his vice president, Hadi. Except everybody hates Hadi. And Saleh, he doesn't respect American traditions and like go to back to his farm in Missouri. He takes his army divisions with him. And he goes, turns out he's a Zaydi Shia all along. He's just not a Houthi. But he's actually from the north. So he goes, he brings his loyal army divisions with him and goes and makes an alliance with the Houthis. Are you with me? So then they start marching south. And by the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, they sack the capital city and drive the sock puppet Hadi out of power. And in doing so, and even Obama himself has admitted this on camera, you can see him explain that, yes, it's a fact that the Iranians warned the Houthis, because they're friends, don't do this. You're going to provoke a terrible reaction from the Saudis. Well, that's exactly what happened. The Saudis freaked out and they wanted to start a war. And by the way, this guy, the Saudi crown prince you're hearing everything about now, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, he's the son of the ailing old king and trying to take his place before his uncles can. He's the one who started this war because he was the brand new 29 or 30-year-old defense minister at the time and needed the credentials. So he wanted to start this war. That was his own public choice theory inside Saudi, right, for why he did it. And then all you have to do is Google the term placate the Saudis. Placate the Saudis. That's all you have to do. And you'll find the New York Times where Obama's men told the New York Times, it wasn't a scoop. This was like a press release. And they said, listen, even though we knew the war would have an indeterminate ending, a long, bloody war with an indeterminate ending, we had to placate the Saudis because, again, they were upset that we signed this nuclear deal with Iran, a nuclear deal which, on the face of it and in reality, absolutely helps to secure Saudis' interests and protect them from the threat of an Iranian nuclear weapon. And But so we have to placate their feelings because they think they might be losing their place in the American Middle Eastern order. So we got to do them a favor. So this is March 2015, and America has helped Saudi bomb and blockade this poorest country in the entire Middle East this whole time. And you won't be surprised to learn, Tom, that previously the IMF and the World Bank had gangsterized the Yemenis out of their local traditional sorghum crops and whatever else they were growing and convinced them to all grow a bunch of coffee and a bunch of other things instead that they can sell on the global market. Because welcome to the global economy, not in a free market sense, but in an IMF World Bank gangsterization through political means sense. And then guess what happened? We put them under blockade and they can't eat coffee. And so now here's a country, the poorest country in the Middle East. They were reliant on imports for 80 to 90% of their food, and then we cut them off. And so there's been at least, 50,000, according to Nasser Arabi, a journalist in Yemen I talk to regularly, at least 50 or 70,000 people have been killed in the violence, but nobody knows how many hundreds of thousands of people are starving to death there. It's been 2.5 years of this, Tom. And they are dying. And there's a massive cholera epidemic. And you know what? I'll go ahead and ruin the fun we're having here and explain that the babies dying of cholera, they vomit and they diarrhea themselves to death. That's what kills them. And that's what the USA is doing to the poorest country in the Middle East. Just across the Red Sea from Somalia, the second poorest country, where we're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say.
It's enough to make you believe in the devil, really. It's something else.
Yeah, it's horrifying. And yet to think that the part of the political spectrum that I came from would have probably been, well, not probably, making excuses for this, cheering it on, or ignoring it, one of those three. And I would have just gone along with that just because, I got to be against Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton is also in favor of this.
It was her president that started the war. I mean, she was involved. I mean, if people just Google Hottie and Google images, you'll see the one man, one name on the ballot from her Democratic election. She hailed it as the advent of democracy in Yemen in 2012. It was her coup that helped lead to this thing. And listen, what they'll say is Iran, Iran, Iran. Well, it's just not true that Iran backs the Houthis in any substantial way at all. It's Gareth Porter's disproven. Most of the accusations rely on a couple of intercepted shipments of weapons, but those were not even from Iran to the Houthis in the first place. It's just made up. There's guns going from here and there. And by the way, where'd they get all their guns? And this is all documented too. You can read a ton about this, that they got their guns from Obama. It was America that armed up their government. As I said, Saleh took army divisions with him when he joined up with the Houthis. There's no question. Yemen is awash in guns like Texas is awash in guns. You don't need an Iranian explanation for these guys' AKs. It's just not true. It's propaganda. In fact, there's a great article by a real scholar named Yost Hilterman. It's called "The Houthis Are Not Hezbollah," which even Hezbollah is not Hezbollah in the sense of being a total sock puppet of Iran. But the Houthis, they're just not. It's simply propaganda. And if you listen to these guys, they will say, oh yeah, Iran, Iran, Iran. It's the new Persian Empire, Iran, Iran, Iran. And yet, who's left in the Middle East other than maybe the Saudi king that Al-Qaeda wants us to overthrow the most? Iran. The mullahs in Iran. Remember when ISIS attacked their shrine in Tehran just a few months ago? And then Trump came out and mocked them and said, well, you support terrorism. That's what you get. ISIS and Al-Qaeda hate the government of Iran, first and foremost. That's what they want to see us do next.
Well, I like to generally try and leave these on an up note, but I don't know how to do that. Is there any way?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I know something funny is, the new report is that Stiglitz was wrong. That kooky economist Stiglitz, he thought that this terror war was going to cost $5 trillion and then later revised it to six. Try eight, pal. Oh, and sorry, eight, that's just the interest on the debt generated to pay for the terror war over the next decades.
No, it can't be $8 trillion of interest.
Well, that was the recent story. It's actually on antiwar.com right now. Post 9/11 war debt will cost $8 trillion in interest.
I'm going to look that.
In Defense One.
All right, let's look.
DefenseOne.com is the report.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. Okay, so over the course of decades of servicing it, so they say so far the U.S. has paid $534 billion in overseas contingency operations interest. So continuing this out, they're saying that ultimately it'll wind up being $8 trillion. Well, regardless of how much time that takes, that's still a lot of money to be spending on the internet. That's unbelievable. And, you know, the thing is, when Stiglitz made that prediction, he was ridiculed for that, right? That's a crazy number. He couldn't possibly believe that, right? I mean, I'm sure he was ridiculed for it.
I actually have a clip here somewhere. I won't bore you with it, but it's Paul Wolfowitz saying, oh, yeah, no, the oil will pay for the war.
Oh, that. Yeah, we definitely had that.
This will be a revenue neutral imperial takeover of the Middle East. Trust me.
Is it a general rule that when the government's that when some reasonably credentialed person says such and such government thing is going to cost X and the government says, what are you kidding me? It won't be anywhere near X. They'll be correct about that. It won't be anywhere near X. It'll be like two or three times X.
Yeah, I know.
Is that just a general rule?
Absolutely. I mean, when you hear him say, yeah, they're going to completely revamp America's nuclear weapons arsenal and it's going to cost $1 trillion over the next decade. Yeah, you can call it three.
Yeah.
Right?
All right. Well, here's some good news. How about the existence of the Libertarian Institute? That's something. Over at libertarianinstitute.org. That's Scott Horton's baby.
I don't know what it is anymore. It was my opportunity to employ William Norman Grigg. Now it's me and Sheldon. And actually, you know what? I shouldn't talk bad about it. It's, you know what? Honestly, I'll say that I did sort of not put a strong enough effort behind the launch of the Institute because I was right halfway through writing this book, Fool's Errand.us. And so it's really time right now to try to do a grand reopening and a relaunch and a doubling down. If there's any hardcore libertarians who oppose things and want to try submitting some articles to the Libertarian Institute, I'm happy to take your submissions, editor@libertarianinstitute.org. And, you know.
And by the way, wasn't that a great bonus of the cruise that one of your favorite contributors to the Libertarian Institute just happened to be a passenger on the cruise and you got to meet him?
Yeah, Eric Schuller, he's just absolutely great on everything. And, you know, Javi is now going to start contributing and writing about Peru and other Latin American situations, mostly involving American intervention, I'm sure.
Well, I know he was very glad to meet. He was one of the musicians we had. I know he was very glad to meet you on board the cruise. Well, check out libertarianinstitute.org. Scott is managing director there, and you will be able to support them while also getting a signed copy of Fool's Errand, which you should be reading, not only because it's great and important and it shows you what a book can be, but secondly, because you're supporting Scott Horton, who does all this thankless work for us. And all you got to do is buy a book. I mean, give me a break. So head over to libertarianinstitute.org because you can get a book with a, if your donation is big enough, you can get a book that way as well. Fool'serrand.us is the site that Scott has for the book. The maps there alone tell a very, very important story. But anyway, I'm going to put all this stuff, Libertarian Institute, Fool's Errand, ScottHorton.org, The Scott Horton Show, all that stuff up at TomWoods.com/1037, as well as articles that we've mentioned, the one about the Houthis and not being Hezbollah, I'll put that up. All this stuff, it's going to be the most incredible Scott Horton and Scott Horton recommended smorgasbord of all time at TomWoods.com/1037. Let's help Scott out. Let me remind you guys, I donate to Scott every month. I send Scott 100 smackers every month because I'm glad he exists, because we need people like Scott Horton who are knowledgeable, who work really hard, who study, who put out great content, and who are fighting for something that's really, really important. And I hope you guys will join me in supporting him and or the Libertarian Institute, where he's the managing director. All right, Scott, thanks for this great conversation today.
You're very kind, Tom. Thank you very much.
All right, everybody, we are approaching Black Friday 2017, and I'm going to be having a big blowout deal on the Lifetime Master Membership at LibertyClassroom.com. It's going to be irresistible. So wait until that date, and I will remind you, in particular if you want to be reminded, what are you not doing on my email list? Get on my email list. I send out good, fun emails. Plus, I give you, guess what? A free ebook when you sign up. So check out tomsfreebooks.com. And if you sign up for one of those books, you will get onto my libertarian email list and you will enjoy being there. And I will tell you when it's time to go, go, go and grab your special deal. You're going to say, man, oh man, am I glad I found out about this, because this is where, again, the point of libertyclassroom.com is that we open up your head and we find those parts of your brain that have any remnants of fake history or bad economics or anything that you just happened to absorb in school that was all wrong. We surgically remove that and we replace it with the truth. It's super, super great. 21 courses now, all kinds of awesome stuff, plus Q&A forums. Never feel stymied in a debate again. So anyway, that's coming up on Black Friday, which is November 24th of this year. So on that day, you're going to want to go over, you're going to want to put this in your Google calendar. You're going to want to go over to libertyclassroom.com and pick up that master membership. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.